Okay, I think we're ready to begin. I'd like to welcome everybody to this session discussing application of software engineering's. Oh, hello. Maybe I'd introduce the two speakers. So on the screen is Stefan Marias in South Africa, I believe. He's experienced in building actuarial code modules and implementing technology solutions to automate business critical calculations for insurance companies end-to-end, such as non-life reserving, life valuations, IFRS 17, reserve uncertainty, and economic capital modeling. He is currently the lead developer for the team building of packaged actuarial models within Dynamo Analytics Software, Cycle, as well as the product owner for Dynamo's new SaaS modeling software. And in person, we have Robert Stefanazzi, who is a UK qualified actuary with extensive experience in his extensive experience in pricing, analytics, and statistical modeling across the insurance industry. He's led the development of innovative solutions combining actuarial techniques with advanced statistical inference and predictive modeling, delivering actionable insights for underwriting and strategy. With a track record spanning Ireland, UK, Germany, Japan, Australia, and other global markets, Robert brings a truly international perspective to modern data-driven decision-making. And I'll hand over to Robert for the first part of the talk.
Thanks, Michael. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming to our talk today. So I'm going to start off talking about some actuarial processes, some workflows, and then I'll hand over to Stefan, who will talk through some paradigms on how to implement the various workflows. So starting off, looking at traditional actuarial processes. So actuarial processes are often suboptimal. So what do I mean by that? Well, they often evolve over time. They're not built in their final state. They can be a mix of new and legacy systems. They can be either too complex or not complex enough. They often lack transparency with manual processes and assumptions made throughout. And oftentimes they can be quite manual. So they're not treating data as a pipeline, and we're manually pulling data from various softwares. So as a result of this, actually spend a lot of time turning over models, producing year-end results. Processes that should, in theory, take a few minutes or a few hours can take days, I can take weeks. I remember one process earlier in my career when we had an Excel template, which was, it was 100 megabytes, and I had to open this Excel spreadsheet, change one cell, hit recalculate, and hit save, and I had to repeat that 40 times. I think the whole thing took me about 2 days. And yeah, it was a total nightmare. So looking at some of the practical challenges that actuaries run into as processes become more complex, oftentimes there's quite poor model governance, little to no version control. Working collaboratively with colleagues can be next to impossible. And it can be hard to reuse other people's code or to reuse code in general. A lot of these challenges are not surprising. We're not software engineers. We're not computer programmers. And we're not typically as familiar with the world of software development. In particular, on version control, I think everywhere I've worked has had a slightly different process to approaching versioning. And oftentimes that includes using the word final to indicate the version, which is usually not best practice. So we ran a survey some time ago looking at actuaries who code in the US. And the first question we asked them was, what software are they using? So what coding language are they using for these various processes? So for ETL, unsurprisingly, it was SQL SAS. For modeling and process orchestration, it was Python and VBA. Process orchestration here is just tying different things together. And then for ad hoc analysis, it was OR. The next question we asked is, what is code been used for. So report generation at 82%, ETL 52%, process orchestration 71%, and modeling 88%. We also asked what was their strategy. So 6% maintaining in-house, we're avoiding maintaining in-house code, 35% maintaining in-house code, and then 59% had a mixed strategy where they're using some form of in-house code and some form of proprietary software. The most interesting statistics for me were these last two. So 65% use Git for version control. I've actually never seen an actor in Ireland use Git for version control. So I actually thought that was quite high. And then 25% had some form of automated testing in place. Now, if this was a software development team, this would look pretty bad, right? This would be a bad software development team if they had such low statistics here. So to give some context on why I say that, I'm going to talk through two different workflows. So the first workflow is the traditional workflow. So it's pretty simple. It's a way a lot of us will intuitively work. So how does it work? It starts off, you define your requirements, then you run through design, then you build it up, you code it, you test, and you implement. So some of the features of this workflow is it's going to cost a lot to make changes later on. So if you get to the testing phase and you realize it's, you know, failing some of your tests, you've missed a requirement, you have to go all the way back to the start. And that can involve, you know, again, roping in senior leadership to go through requirements, and can be quite a costly exercise. So the kind of corollary of that is that you have to be very confident at the beginning that you have all your design perfect and to make those key decisions at the start. So what is it good for? So it is good for simple and unchanging projects, things where when you're very confident at the beginning that you have all your requirements mapped out. It's probably the best workflow for those situations. So there's a book on DevOps called The Phoenix Project, in which the authors list some challenges with teams that implement a traditional workflow. So some of these challenges are that defects are passed downstream. There can be an inability to distinguish what had an impact versus what didn't. Debugging takes too much time. And oftentimes when teams are running the traditional workflow, there'll be a lot of siloing of work. And then related to siloing, so we have this Conway's Law, which states, I'm going to read it, organizations who design systems are constrained to produce designs which are copies of the communication structures of these organizations. So a bit of a mouthful, I'm going to read it a second time. Organizations who design systems are constrained to produce designs which are copies of communication structures of these organizations. So what does this mean in practice? Well, very often in general insurance, we'll have a pricing team, we'll have a reserving team. The communication between those teams can be pretty poor. Sometimes it can be non-existent. Maybe the teams are in different countries. Maybe only communication is in a formal setting between senior members of both of those teams. And then as a result of that, you get a lot of duplication of processes. You'll have pricing actuaries doing claims triangles. They'll have their own view on ultimates. And there's like two sources of truth within the company and a lot of duplication of work. So that's Conway's Law. So next workflow is the modern workflow. So a common workflow used in development ops. So quite similar to the traditional workflow in terms of its steps. So you go through the same, you think about requirements, you plan it out, design, develop. And then crucially, the difference here is that you're running through a track and monitor process. And rather than being a linear workflow, it's cyclical. So you're constantly iterating and improving on last times. So how do you implement this in practice? Well, at the start, you assume that you're going to make mistakes in design. So you're in situations where you know you're not super confident that you've definitely captured every requirement. Then you proceed in small steps. You optimize workflows for learning and changing quickly. And you, very importantly, you rely on customer feedback. And then this workflow, more suitable for large and complex projects when you're, as I said at the beginning, when you're not confident in getting those requirements. So I guess the point here isn't that the modern workflow is good and the traditional workflow is bad, rather that they're each good in specific circumstances. So some useful paradigms to help implement the modern workflow. As you can see here, test-driven development, continuous delivery, fail fast, and domain-driven design. So Stefan will talk through some of these paradigms in a little bit more detail. So yeah, thank you. I'm going to hand over to Stefan now to take the second half.
Okay, thank you. Can I just get a quick indication of if you guys can see the slide?
Not yet.
Give me a heads up and you can see.
Yeah, we can see.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, so I'm going to try and make this a little bit interesting and start by saying once upon a time, there was an actuary who studied in the 80s, and this actuary, when this person for the first time used computers, this guy, let's say his name is John. John loved coding. John freaked out. He really enjoyed using computers, putting things together, writing little applications to do various arbitrary tasks. It was totally his hobby. So John was actually really popular for that reason at his workplace, like a large life insurance company. So he was able to actually be that member of the actuarial team who was the link between the systems guys, the IT guys, the computer engineering guys, and the actuarial. So when it was late 90s, so this was obviously back in the day where you kept your job. You didn't move the company every 2 years. So when it was late 90s, they actually asked him, John, do you want to maybe change role? Do you want to work with the IT guys to actually help build like a pricing model? So what John did is he would help the IT guys work with them, and together they actually built a pricing model in COBOL, in mainframe, and it worked amazing. So now they were actually able to link this pricing model up directly to some website somewhere. And when you actually click request quote, it's actually calculating the real, it's doing a proper calculation. So this was amazing. It was amazing for the company. It was innovative. But it came with its challenges because it mainly had one maintainer, and this person, John, had his own style of coding, his own way of writing code, his own way of defining the variables. Also, he's not really, like, he thinks documentation is quite boring. So I'm hoping that raises a bunch of smiles in the room, you've maybe seen similar sort of behavior. So let's jump into the theory, and then we'll get back to John in a second. So introducing test-driven development, commonly just referred to as TDD. So this is basically the most popular modern day tool that software developers use to actually enhance the stability and quality of software. So in simple terms, a very simple definition, it's a technique for building software that guides software development by writing tests. So how does this work? You start off with one requirement. Okay, so say we need to add something to the system. It needs to generate an email when a certain event happens. Okay. You then take this requirement and you start by actually not building the code, but building an automated test. So you literally build a test application which checks that if this action happens in the software, we expect a result. So we expect a email to come back. So you write the test, and when you run this test on the system, the test says it's failing. The system is not doing what it's supposed to be doing. So that's the red box. So when you run it, it's red. So it fails. And then what you do is you simply focus to make this test pass. You don't reinvent the wheel. You don't do it in the cleanest possible way. You just simply focus on the objective by writing the code. And then, so then you have the red, green effect. So you start off with the test fails. Now the test passes because you did a simple crude approach. And after the test, the very first step, the test passes, then only do you spend time on improving the code. We call that refactoring. So here you would focus on speed, on making it modular, adding the documentation to the code. And once you're happy, then the whole thing goes in for review, by a peer, and it goes into the main repository, the repository of source control. Okay. So that's test driven development. And then you iterate. You take the next requirement, or you maybe find edge cases. And that's where the update as we learn. So as we implement the feature, you might find that, we forgot about to be detailed enough in the requirements, because we realized that when you do this action, there's already other notifications that happen when this action happens. So you might as well rethink the whole situation slightly so that the notification is similar via email and maybe via some other channel. So as you implement, you often learn things, and then that feeds back into the test cases. Cool. So that's the test-driven development. The test drives the development process, but also, once you're done with this, the test is still there. You're able to now automatically run this test. And in this test, every time you make a change to the system, this test checks whether someone's breaking something. So let's apply this to actuarial work. So back to John. John is now at the point of retiring soon, or he's already actually retired, and his team had to take over, or let's put it this way. So with John being in retirement, the company has continually been contracting John to bring him back to make a small change to his original code. At some point the actual team is tasked with rebuilding this price engine. Okay, so say we're actually tasked with writing something new, say it's in Python or some other more modern language instead of COBOL. What we do is we start with a single hypothesis. So let's say if you want to price an assurance policy, if you set all the assumptions to zero, expenses zero, mortality zero, interest rate to zero, then you can expect that the sum of the assurance sums up to one. Okay. So sum of all the cash flows, I mean. So let's put that in a test. So let's start with this hypothesis. If this is the input, these are the assumptions, then we expect this to be the result. So we write a very simple test of that. And then we just take this test and we write code just to make that pass. Okay. So initially when you run it, like your pricing function, it fails because it couldn't even do anything, when you start. But then once you've actually implemented all the cash flows and you can it all sums up to one, then it passes. And then you take the next hypothesis. So a key way of doing this is you can maybe take the existing pricing system and check a bunch of inputs, capture that as a test input to a test, take the current output, and you basically write that as a test. So basically you take a couple scenarios of the results of the different pricing engine, and you create unit tests of that. So that would be a great way to go about this. And yeah, the main thing here is just write a simplistic model. Start with that. Don't overcomplicate things from the start. And then once you implement the features, you've got the tests passing, and you've got something to fall back on. So if you break something, you sort of trust the system now. If your tests were set up really well, then it just improves the whole quality of the process. So now you have time to refactor, to improve the model structure, make it faster, make it more modular, add documentation, go through all the different steps. And then you just repeat this for more edge cases and other scenarios. And just a key note here, I think, so some of you might have already made the connection, but this test-driven development and unit tests concept is actually quite similar to what we understand model checks is. Like in actuarial studies, you would have learned about model checks, that you check the data, do some fact checks on the model, some sense checks. These things can all actually be automated in the same way in this test-driven development approach. All right. Now, to introduce continuous delivery. So let's go back to John. So in John's scenario, he was building every time the company would request him to make a change or to add a feature to this pricing model, he would go away, understand the requirements, and basically just write the code. And make sure that it is implemented. But every time he hears the new requirements, and as he reads his code, he kind of realizes that he made some design mistakes. So he actually changes quite a bit along the way. And so he touches more than just what he has to because of feature maintainability and because he's learned from his previous mistakes, right? And then what happens is after that, he deploys the code, and then they figure out, oh, but he actually broke some other scenarios. So it needs to be thoroughly tested by a whole actuarial team. And then after that, after it's tested, it's signed off, and then his code can be deployed by the IT team. Okay. That might also sound familiar, hopefully. So introducing continuous delivery. So just first the theory. So you start with continuous integration. So some of you might have heard of CI/CD. So that's the CI part. So continuous integration is basically a team collaboratively work on the same piece of code. So this continuous integration says that if one person makes a change, once they're done with that change, it's immediately integrated into the main branch or the main version of source control. Source control being just the files, all the code files together. So it basically says that as soon as I'm done with something, it's updated on the main CLS virtual live version that everyone is working on. And I try to break my code up in smaller steps so that, for example, if I'm making 5 to 10, and if I'm doing 5 to 10 features at a time, these changes might be in conflict with someone else's changes because they're also tasked to work on something similar. So if I actually, work in small steps, the merging process of consolidating each other's work is actually a lot less. There's less cost involved if I work in smaller steps and continually integrate. Because that's continuous integration. Continuous integration also involves running your unit tests. So it involves running your automated tests. So every time I make a change request, basically, a pull request, the pipeline that I've set up automatically checks whether I've broken something. So there's immediately I know whether I've introduced a bug. So it 80% of the time, bugs are caught immediately. Okay. So that's the modern workflow on continuous integration. So continuous integration, I would say, is if in software development companies, in teams, they don't have this set up well. Like, this is where a lot of the workflow the quality of the workflow improves a lot by doing continuous integration well. And then you get continuous delivery. So continuous delivery is where so if I made my changes, I've got a pipeline which basically builds my code, it runs the tests, and it then deploys it to a staging environment. So the staging environment has an automatic way of running integration tests. So it would basically test whether, if I were to deploy maybe this pricing model in the life insurance company context, it would test whether any APIs, any external systems with calling its API, whether the whole system still works. So it actually tests how it integrates with the rest of all the bits and pieces. So thinking of a sort of a microservices setup. So you run your integration tests. There might be stress tests. There might be, so like that's a load test part, and maybe some other system checks that happen, maybe security checks. There might be manual testing happening or manual approvals that need to happen on the staging environment. And once it's proved, it is deployed onto production, typically automatically. So hopefully you have a setup where that is streamlined and automatic, but it's a lot of times that part is still manual. Okay. So continuous deployment is a variation. So that is where it just means that all the checks done on the staging environment are automated and deployments to production happen automatically. So that is a more extreme scenario. So you need to invest a lot more in your automated testing framework in order to be able to do that. But this is what a lot of companies do these days, and they find that improves the quality of the system the most, because if changes are automatically pushed to all users, to all environments, that's the fastest way of finding defects and fixing and responding to those bugs. So in summary, continuous delivery aims to make changes without disrupting your organization. The system must always be in a deployable or a model in a runnable state. After every small change, must be deployable and runnable. And lastly, use pipelines and automated workflows to orchestrate all the delivery stages. Right, so does this work? Okay. And just explaining a bit of the reasons, of the motivations behind doing this, because it's a lot of work to set up, and the learning curve is also big to set up this approach. Studies have found that, so this is from studies that were done and written in the form of a book called Accelerate, published in 2018. This study actually found that there is no trade-off between speed and quality when it comes to software development. Now that might sound counterintuitive, But there are good reasons for that, because it comes down to teams that have implemented a really good and thorough continuous delivery process, and teams who haven't. And there's even, in some cases, there's even a positive correlation between how fast a team can add new features and the quality. That also sounds counterintuitive. Finding was that, it's not so much about the clever architectural techniques that you use, or the coding language, or the technology. It's not about that, but it's actually more about your team, the people and practices that affect the stability of the software. So it's not so what I mean by that, it's not about whether you're using JavaScript and the Vue framework to build a web app, or the or traditional just plain JavaScript, or whether you use .NET stack or whatever. It's not really about the technology. It's more about people and practices. So that was also very, very interesting. So just some stats here, just to highlight. So from this book, what they highlight is teams who apply continuous delivery have a 90% lower defect rate. So that's basically the defects are bugs that are deployed in production. And it's just another one I want to highlight is there's actually 44% more time available to spend on new work as opposed to just maintaining the system and fixing existing bugs. Just expanding on the people and practices first part, and it being more about the way you work together. So high performing teams, they factor in quality from the start. They work in small batches, so small batches of changes. They focus a lot on simplifying and automating all repetitive work. And they pursue continuous development, continuous personal development, and continuous improvement of the system relentlessly. So they have a big ambition for that. And from a management perspective, everyone is responsible for the quality and maintainability of the system instead of just the lead person. And everyone focuses on the bigger picture. So that's what they found a high, the qualities of a high performing team is versus a poor performing dev team. Now this might look familiar. You might see the same in your company, in an actuarial team. So, and then just something that which is very interesting is the publishers of the book or the authors of the book have come up with what they call the DORA metrics. Now, these are metrics that you can use to objectively rate the performance of the software development team. So you measure frequency of deployments, time delay in when new work is accepted and by the time it's deployed, so that time delay, and you measure basically how many times that was necessary to roll back a release that went into production. So if you release, how many times was there a change failure and we have to roll back? And also, when there's an incident, how quick are we able to restore that incident? So that's average time to restore a system failure. So if you use those metrics, this is the way that you measure the performance of a software company. And this is also, I find it very interesting because this is actually something that we can learn from in how we measure the performance of our actuarial teams, perhaps. There's just some stats there. And so there are big differences between high performing and poor performing teams when you look at these stats, massive differences. All right. So let's apply this to actuarial work. So how would we be able to do this? So first of all, using Excel, it's going to be tough. You need to select software that actually enables you to be able to do continuous delivery. So you need to continually make changes to your system. So like work in small batches. So traditionally, and this is just talking a bit about a culture I've seen in actuarial teams a lot, where typically once a year we say let's allow changes to my model. And then we go into the whole development phase where we revisit assumptions, we revisit the modeling approach, the methods. We look at the speed of the model. We try and address a bunch of problems all at the same time. And then because we've made so many changes to the model once a year, we actually need to go through a very extensive and often the budget or the time budget on this overruns a very expensive UAT, user acceptance testing process. So we test all the changes and find many defects because we've made so many changes in one at once that it yeah. So I've seen this a lot, this sort of pattern, and that culture would need to change in order to do continuous delivery. So that's just something interesting to think about. So I think a relentless pursuit of also automation and be able have the ability to automatically run model checks and reconciliations. So a relentless pursuit of that would be key. All right, and then just to conclude, so building a good process is critical for the business, and it's really hard. It's hard to implement this. Doing continuous delivery, I can tell from experience, it's hard to get this right. There's a big learning curve. This is what makes software development hard, I would say. Being able to work in a way in which you don't make disruptions to a system in production, and you can safely make changes. Getting that set up is hard. The learning curve is big, but it's so worth it. So that's my conclusion. And now it's time for questions. Thank you very much.
Anybody like to go up to the microphone and ask some questions? Okay, I'll start. I'll ask, I think it's probably to Stefan. So what actual applications are best suited for experimenting with the continuous delivery principles?
So just to clarify, what do you mean by applications?
What models is it? Pricing it's useful for? Is it reserving something else?
Okay, I just wanted to know if it's that or if it's soft like software. So I would say, sorry, is that for continuous delivery or test-driven delivery?
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
Do you mean applications? Do you mean all the principles that I spoke about, or specifically test-driven development or continuous delivery?
I'm just interested in continuous delivery at the moment.
Oh, all right. So I would say the pricing example is quite a key one. If you get that right, what you're able to do is you can have a dynamic pricing workflow. So where you can respond to demands in the market. So where you see a competitor is pricing lower for a certain thing, and you can quickly make changes. And respond to changing assumptions, economic assumptions. So it allows that ability. Instead of like just reviewing your pricing model once a year, you can actually do it whenever. So that actually adds a lot of business value. That's one application. But I would say it can be applied in reserving context, in capital modeling. It's just anything that is typically built and recurring. So recurringly it needs to run. It's not well suited for a once-off analysis or just an exploratory once-off thing in the data, and next time you need to do it, the exercise will look different. That's not when it's suitable.
So yeah, please go to the microphone, please, so it can be caught for recording.
You gave the story earlier of someone releasing code that ended up accidentally breaking some other stuff. So I'm by no means an expert of this, but my understanding is that you would test for that in regression testing. Is regression testing something that's separate, or is that something that is a subset or within your framework of continuous delivery and or the test-driven approach?
That's a great question. So regression testing is basically a testing approach, which you pre-set up a whole bunch of tests and scenarios. And every time you make big changes, then you run the regression testing suite, like your suite of tests. Typically, regression testing is not automated. That's the first thing. So when I talk about things in a continuous delivery sense, what I mean with those tests, so the terminology is actually acceptance tests. So what an acceptance test is it's an end-to-end automated test. So the terminology, it changes slightly, but it's similar to regression tests, but typically regression tests are manually done by a testing team or a quality assurance team. In this case, the acceptance tests are actually maintained by the software engineering team. If that answers the question.
So any other questions?
Follow up.
Any follow-up questions? Well, it just leaves us to thank the speakers for bringing in a piece of knowledge from outside actuarial. And I'm sure it'll be useful to many of people in the audience. Thank you.